No, seriously, I am absolutely honored to be talking with you today. As I said the other day, this is a very, very intimidating moment for a historian. I'm looking at the audience and I say, what am I doing here telling you about your history? I mean, I look upon the group here and it is clearly living history. I mean, also the present, but I look around this audience and I see people I just have such respect for that I feel a little bit humbled and a little bit absurd telling you a little bit about it. I think you know some of the formal history that was outlined by Dave Michaels, and if you were at the SCAFA meeting the other day, you heard Dave Cuttlechuck give a very, very nice presentation of the transformation of our section over the course of the past 100 years. He outlined very nicely the changing demographics of our section, who's in it now, what they believed then, and what has happened in between. To me, it's kind of startling, and I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't have to sign consent forms, but I want to take a picture of this audience, because if you go over here to the right and you look at the original history of both our section and people who are participating in industrial health, I think you'll notice a very dramatic difference in the makeup of that audience. That audience in 1913 and the other one is in 1935, the larger one, I think you can notice there's one very significant factor that's very, very different. Can anybody name it? What's that? Beards. Beards and open collars. Whatever it is. It is a very different audience, a very different group who began occupational safety and health in the APHA and in the professional organizations. And what I'm going to do today is try to trace a little bit about the ongoing obvious assumption that we all have in this room, that in some sense the health of the workforce is a product of very, very deep struggle, in part between management and labor. That's an assumption I think many people in our audience share today, but was not necessarily uniformly shared in previous eras. What I want to outline is how, one, we got to this point in 1914 that we would see audiences of middle-aged white men at major dinners talking about the health of the workforce with barely a worker involved, without a worker there. And what I want to point out is not that I don't want to undercut our own history, but what I want to point out is that we came from a very different place. That in some sense, the struggle to form the section was both a very intrinsic part of progressive era America, the 19-teens, when Alice Hamilton and some of the people we looked to for leadership were absolutely critical in our collective memory. But it was also part of a negotiation, an ongoing negotiation, an ongoing form of contention about who was going to control the nature of disease, who was going to define what was an occupational hazard, who caused it, what was the danger involved, who should bear the risk of the new industrial workplace that was emerging during this period of time. This is a period that you all know was of enormous importance in industrial history. We were emerging from an agrarian society, a society built around small towns and agricultural communities, into a major industrial society where immigrants and workers were being dragged into factories, closed spaces, and being exposed to hazards they had never, never before seen. What I want to just briefly do is, the problem with history, of course, is that whenever you ask a historian to start talking about something, they say, well, we have to go back in time and explain the circumstances in which the event that people want to hear about actually happened. And, of course, I'm going to do that because I think it would really be unfair of us to think about the history of struggle over the definitions of disease, definitions of occupational safety and health, without planting it firmly in a very long history of inequality in American society, inequality in work, and a contentious debate about the control of work. These are just two little examples. I think we all have to remember very clearly that most of American history, or most of the European period from European migration to the United States or to the North American continent, has been shaped by very unequal labor relations. And what I mean by that is that it was an accepted fact of life that there were power relationships between a worker and an employer that were not necessarily equal. Okay? Of course, the biggest example of that is what? Slavery. More than half of our history has been defined by that central institution, right? In which there was no assumption that the right of a worker, that there was a right of a worker, okay? We had indentured servitude, and we had an assumption really coming out of feudal Europe, in which the lord had power over the serf, where the master had power over the servant, where the owner had power over the slave, that was accepted by broad swaths of America. I want to frame that because I think when we talk about who we're going to blame for injuries at work, how we're going to contend over it, that this issue became a central characteristic, a defining characteristic for all of occupational safety and health. Who are we going to blame? Who are we going to hold responsible? These are just two. I just pulled these two things up as a way of kind of orienting ourselves. So these are both from 1841, two law cases, one in the slave South and the other one in the free North in Massachusetts, of course, Tisch's home state, right? One was a slave ship in which there was a rebellion, and that rebellion ended with the ship being brought to the Bahamas. And I'm going to, needless to say, I could spend 4 days on this case. It's fascinating when you read it. Brought to the Bahamas, where the British, who had eliminated slavery in 1835 as an institution, deemed that the people on board the slave ship were free. Okay? The suit remained a critical part of our understanding of the rights of owners and the rights of slaves, or the lack of rights of slaves, in American history because a lawsuit was brought against the insurance companies in which the Americans claimed that these were not human beings and therefore they were like cattle and needed to be insured for loss. The simple fact is that we developed a very harsh view of what workers, people who are doing our work, really, really deserved. The other case is North Thorwell versus Boston Railroad, which became the basis of what we would call the fellow servant rules and the assumption of risk assumptions in American law, in which workers were made responsible for the work they did. And we could talk about this, but they both embody some very basic facts of life, which is that very late in our history, it was assumed that the worker had no rights. Under slavery, he had no power, and under freedom, even in the North, this worker lost the right to any kind of compensation. We don't have to talk about that. This is just to give you a grounding of how pernicious this idea of inequality in the workplace was. I'm going to talk about the history of the formation of the section, but also the history of work in America through examples that are drawn from some of my books. Okay? Jerry and I have written a number of books. One is Deadly Dust, which is a history of silicosis that David just mentioned, and an ongoing contention over silicosis. The second, which was published in the 1990s. The second one is Deceit and Denial, which was published in 2002, which was not about an individual worker or an individual liability, but was now about environmental danger. The poisons that were created in the workplace that were slowly leaking out. And finally, Lead Wars, which is raising issues today about who is going to win in the ongoing struggle about how to define low-level exposures, low-level damage that we are now contending with in public health. I'm going to basically talk about in terms of the contention over the narrative for control of disease. Who's going to control it? And that's what I want to place all these three books in and this history in. I'm going to start out with a little letter I got a number of years ago after I was asked to testify in a case about lead. And the point about this is that history is becoming very contended, because who is going to control the narrative is going to prove very, very important, not only in lawsuits, but in the way we think about disease. Who's going to control that narrative? Is it going to be a narrative that sees the worker as responsible for his own fate and responsible for the diseases that he covers and is suffering from? Or is it going to be owners who are seen as having a responsibility? This is from a consulting group called the Roundtable Group that wrote me a letter when I was about to appear in a lead case based upon a book I had written a number of years ago. And here's what they wrote. I'm writing to introduce you to Roundtable Group and to notify you of a specific short-term consulting opportunity which may be of interest. Our attorney client is seeking an historian, highly credentialed and at a prestigious university. I guess that was me. Okay. To perform some historical research and instruct a lay jury on what was known about a particular occupational hazard, lead paint contamination, between 1950 and 1980. At that time, we were preparing a case with the Attorney General about the responsibility of industry to having poisoned the entire state of Rhode Island with lead paint. And the Attorney General of Rhode Island, who's now Senator Whitehouse here, had prepared a suit in which he was saying that because this industry knew, based on our historical documents, that damage was... I'm sorry, you all right? You can come around this way. Yeah, I'm sorry. Trying to get around that way would be tough. That because the industry knew about what it was putting on the walls and the damage it was doing to children in the 1920s and 1930s based on historical documents, he wanted money from this industry to remove a nuisance, remove this from the lead, from the walls of the cities, Providence and other cities in the state, because it was going to poison kids in the future. It was a perfect public health preventive lawsuit. How can we stop something that is going to happen, that we know will happen, but how can we get the money to do it? So this was the context. I was about to testify for the state based on our documents. The historian, this research group said, need not be a subject matter expert, which I found very interesting, basically. I didn't have to know what I was talking about. Our client is mainly interested to find an historian who's a good communicator. I was pleased by that. Someone who can easily communicate a story to a jury. Again, the courtroom itself was part of this ongoing contention, this ongoing struggle between contending views of causes of damage to children in this case, whether it was an industrial product produced by industries, or was it their fault, the mother's fault, the children's fault, the community's fault. And this was, you know, their response, to find a historian who could communicate the story. RTG, this made me a little paranoid, okay? RTG is a consortium of several thousand professors and industry experts in management, law, medicine, science, computer science, education, engineering, economics, and other disciplines, I guess that was history, who make themselves available to provide customized expert witness and consulting services. The point I'm trying to make with these slides is that there's an enormous stake in how the narrative of our understanding of disease is being formed. There are enormous stakes that are historically continuous, from the moment of the Creoles grounding in the Bahamas right through the present, in which we're constantly struggling over a narrative of who's going to have the right to explain and explore and understand why workers and why communities are getting sick. So that's what I'm going to try to shape and show you through some of these slides. I'm going to mostly focus on, this is just the end of it, you know, if you're interested in being a consultant, name your price. That was basically what. Let me tell you a little bit how I got involved in these lawsuits, because I've become very, very involved in them. I almost see this as kind of a historical enactment, a historical moment in which these lawsuits, this contention. It's not happening on the shop floor because unions have been so destroyed in so many ways, but it's now happening in these court cases below the radar of experts. It's all happening below the radar, a huge contention about what disease is, who should be responsible for disease, and who should be bear the risks of work. In 1991, as I mentioned, we published this book on silicosis called Deadly Dust. It was a small academic book. I don't know, is Rosemary Sokas in the audience? No? She's there. I just have to mention this. Got rave reviews except from Rosemary. She gave me the one critical review. It appeared in the New England Journal. And the review basically said, I hope you don't mind this, Rosemary, okay? It's meant with love. But she said, reading this book is like making love and having to go downstairs to answer the bell every 5 minutes because I put the footnotes on the bottom of the page. The point is, it was not meant as a narrative for the broad public. It was an extremely narrow little study of a disease that I had considered obscure, that no one had heard of before, right? Or at least I hadn't heard of it. But that had been fascinating me because of a whole series of experiences I had had going and visiting Lauren Kerr down in Washington. And I'll tell you just very briefly about that. It was a book that was really meant to reach about 7 other historians, okay, and my mother, who was my biggest market. She lived in Century Village down in Florida. That was a great market for me. I'm not good at this. But in any case, I'm sorry. This is a celebration, so I hope you don't mind if I'm a little bit looser than I might be in a professional academic audience, okay? I just feel like this is a celebratory moment also. But it was really not meant to be sold. You know, like all academics, I really saw my life as residing in a library, not having much to do with people. So in any case, but about 6 months after Jerry and I had published this book, we got a phone call from the press. And the press said, look, we're going to put your book out in paperback, which for an academic means they sold the 7 copies they made, right? You know, or whatever the number was. I mean, it sold about 2,000 copies, which is a big seller for an academic book. And I said, wait, this is 6 months later. You know, usually it takes around 10 years for that to happen. What are you putting it out in paperback? I said, well, it's sold out, and we're going to, you know, obviously it's a popular book. It got a little reward here and there. And we said, well, who bought it? And they said, well, it must be labor historians. And I said, no, labor historians at that point were talking about guys going out on strike and then going to the bar afterwards and drinking together. I said, well, maybe it's many labor historians. Please, if there are labor historians in the room, don't take offense. But that was, we were talking about reconstructing the history of the union movement. They said, well, maybe medical historians. They said, no, medical historians are still debating whether or not Halstead really invented the rubber glove. I mean, this is, you know, the burning issues in medical history at that time. So I said, it wasn't them. Who is it? And they looked at it, and they found out that it was being sold throughout in bizarre places, Butte, Montana, Biloxi, Mississippi, a town called Odessa, Texas, and it was going out after a little inspection to law firms because it seemed that there were silicosis cases going on throughout the country. Now, this book, you have to understand, was about 200 pages of detail of the years 1936 to 1938, basically, right? I mean, I'd like to say it was a lot more, but it's about a whole crisis in the 1930s when silicosis was defined as a major struggle and a major epidemiological crisis with over 500,000 workers being assumed to be exposed and potentially victims of silicosis. And what the book was built around is a very academic, arcane problem, which is how could a disease that's affecting 500,000 people, that's a chronic illness that takes decades to appear, that's due to exposures decades before, right? How could it virtually vanish from the public health literature a decade later by the 1940s? And it was a book about the politics of how we both discover disease and forget it when it's not convenient. And it's a book built around the idea that, you know, disease is something that we as a society negotiate and we as a society define, and depending upon who has power and who has control, it's either going to be defined as a problem or it's going to be defined out of existence. That was really the kind of little academic exercise the book was about. But it fell into these lawsuits because of all these lawsuits over silicosis that were occurring in all sorts of regions of the country out of the public view. And out of even the professional view, I hate to say. I think that, you know, if you looked in 1984, you probably wouldn't see many articles in AJPH about silicosis. We learned very quickly what this issue was about because we ended up being called very, very quickly by law firms to testify in cases. And the first case was in this town of Odessa, Texas. Are there any Texans in the room? Okay. I don't want to offend Texans, okay? I don't want to offend Texans. They carry guns, right? Yeah. But the simple fact is that I traveled down to Odessa, Texas, to testify in a lawsuit, and it was literally like going to the end of the earth. I mean, for a New York boy from Manhattan, it was really very, very far away. You go to a town that's built around oil wells, that's built around the oil industry, that's in the middle of, it's the end of a road that goes straight from Fort Worth Airport straight out to this town. You could literally, the plane followed the road as we traveled down it. It was literally about 5 feet above the ground. But you go into this town and you realize how much of America is working under conditions that are just horrendous. The case was about an outbreak that was discovered by this guy, Steve Weisenfeld, a doctor who had somehow landed in Odessa. I have no idea how. But he had been treating Mexican immigrants who had been coming up from Mexico at the behest of Citgo and a number of oil companies, right, to reinvigorate the oil industry during the 1970s and early 1980s, 20 minutes, oh boy, 1970s and 1980s. And the simple message that came out of this is that these guys had been sent into these tanks with bandanas, did sandblasting to clean out tanks, and ended up coming down with silicosis, acute silicosis, very quickly and dying. And he was discovering these folks. Okay, he thought they had tuberculosis, but they weren't responding. He sent pathology sections to Abraham up at the University of Syracuse, who did a pathology exam and found that the lungs were filled with sand. That's the history. He had never heard of this disease. They're filled with sand. During that time, I actually was a witness in that trial, the first of these trials. Well, I'm not going to go into it. I don't have time. Okay. But it was a very moving moment because I met the family of the worker, and I was thanked by that family in the hall. And she spoke no English, and she said she wanted to thank a New York professor for coming down and testifying for her husband. And the short story is that I told her, you know, it didn't look very good because this was an Anglo jury, and I could tell from the stand that this was not going well. They were not going to give money to a Mexican immigrant. And she said to me, no, I'm just thanking you for coming down because this is not about money. I just want somebody to tell a jury, tell people that my husband's life was worth something. This is what happened almost immediately after with the silicosis cases, just to give you a sense of how contentious this issue is, of what history does. This was an article in LexisNexis, which is the publication published by the Wall Street Journal for lawyers, right? And it was called On Deadly Dust and Histrionic Historians. And I should have understood what was going to happen very shortly afterwards, because this was laying it out for me. And it also very clearly, probably more than any single document, clearly understood the stakes of who controlled the narrative. The works of Professor Rosner and Mark Witz raise important questions about the role historians seek to play in litigation. In writing about social, labor, and political history of silicosis, Rosner and Mark Witz interpret and draw inferences from the past. They excoriate the motives that he accuses us of all sorts of things. They excoriate the motives and actions of industry, even when supported by sound science or when the plight of workers was ameliorated. We could safely leave the fate of Rosner and Markowitz's historical scholarship to their community of academicians. Essentially, they don't really care what historians do. Yeah. As long as they play in their own yard. Academicians and historians, if not for one discomforting fact, either directly through their participation in court cases as expert witnesses, or indirectly through their opinions offered or sneaked into evidence. And this is a book that was about the 1930s. I mean, nobody read it. I mean, you know. The views of Rosner and Markowitz have become part of the passion play that we call silicosis litigation. You know, the point is, at that point, we should have understood the stakes in how this story is told, and in some sense, the importance of historical narrative in controlling that story. There's enormous amounts at stake here, and I think we're all part of that continual story of negotiation. This is what happened a few years later. 20 of the biggest chemical companies in the United States have launched a campaign to discredit two historians who have studied the industry's efforts to conceal links between their products and cancer. In an unprecedented move, attorneys for Dow, Monsanto, Goodrich, Goodyear. Can you imagine having lawyers from all these guys? Little historian. Union Carbide and others have subpoenaed and deposed five academics who recommended that the University of California publish their book, blah, 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 blah. Another article about that. It was kind of like made a little mini news in the academic community. But let me get to the gist of this story, because I know that, you know, you're very patient. The little image on top is borrowed from my wonderful colleague, Amy Fairchild, who put that on. I love that. But responsibility for chronic industrial disease. I'm going to go through what you've already seen and heard about, the Triangle Fire, the country having gone through massive industrialization, movements of millions of people in the cities. For the first time, more Americans lived in cities than on the countryside in 1920. And here is one of the, you know, iconic moments in the history of occupational disease and occupational safety and health, which, of course, is the Triangle Fire, where women jumped to their deaths from 9 stories up, policemen watching them jump. And here's the response. You all remember this. I'm not going to belabor it, but you all know about what happened after this. And here's one of the responses that was at stake when the Occupational Safety and Health section was begun. The fact that death on the job was becoming part of a major labor movement was being seen as an indication not of the inability of technicians to control a workplace, but was being defined as a labor issue in which women and men and their lives were being literally sacrificed in the labor struggle. This is the Lady Waist and Dressmakers Union organizing about around the issue of safety and health. We mourn our loss, the United Hebrew Trades, my grandmother. This is March 1914 when our section's being formed. And what I want, I'm going to skip over this, but what I want to point out is how diseases, occupational diseases, were defined at that point. Because essentially what's being identified here is a whole language that's really up for grabs. It's not a technical language. Defining disease was very clearly linked to either industrial product or to a place, the workplace. Lead colic, miner's asthma, hatter's shakes, mercury poisoning, what we would call mercury poisoning, potter's rot, boiler maker's deafness. The point that I'm trying to make here is that the language of disease was really being identified as an area of contention even at this moment. What were we going to call it? Who was going to control the definition of what it was? Were we going to institute identification, means of identification that really were only understandable by experts? Were they only understandable by a small community of elites, or were they understandable by the masses of people who were dying from what was then called, for example, miner's phthisis, or glassblower's rot, which we would now call silicosis? I'm going to just skip over some of these. I want to show you this movie that is kind of like a... I want to figure out if it works. This is a movie made at the time the section was being formed. It's called The Temple of Moloch. And in it, if you look at it, you will see a number of different themes emerge. And I'm not going to show you the whole thing. You're going to see a worker who is coming out of a pottery coughing, right? And out of that pottery, he's going to come and ultimately, as you'll see, be fired by a boss. Okay? He's going to then go home, and you'll see in a second, he's going to be confronted by a doctor who's going to say the problem you have is not an industrial disease, but it actually is an environmental disease called tuberculosis. This is the height of the bacillus, the bacterial revolution, right? The worker is being fired, he goes home, and at the home, he's visited by the doctor. The point I want to make over here is that at this point, when we're being formed, there's struggle going on how disease is going to be defined. Is it going to be defined as a technical problem of doctors who are concerned about an infectious disease that's environmental in origins, or is it going to be defined by the worker who sees it rooted in the workplace? This is just a little scene of his home. Watch what the guy does. The doctor is advising... The doctor says, do not allow anyone to drink after you, okay, because you're going to communicate the disease to your child, okay. The child's on the floor. Watch what happens. The doctor goes and opens the window because one of the assumptions about tuberculosis is that it was a disease of closed spaces and dusty environments. And here's the doctor giving the family a way of understanding the disease that has very little to do. Don't sweep your floor. Pick up the baby, get him off the floor, and the baby now, of course, because he was just swept over, right? He breathed into dust, and now he's sick. Okay? Magically. Allow me to send your baby to a preventorium. Okay? Okay. Don't hug your baby, you silly woman. Don't you understand? You're going to catch it, too. The point I'm trying to make is not to make fun of this film. It's a moment in time when there are all sorts of possible interpretations working in the same place. Is it the factory? Is it the exploitation of the owner? Is it the bacteria? Is it the home environment? Is it class? He leaves, the expert leaves, she closes the window, and of course we know what happens. The baby, of course, dies. She closed the window, she put him back on the floor, and the baby comes back and dies. The end of the story, because I don't have very much time, 10 minutes, oh God, is simply that the worker ends up having his vengeance by having his daughter catch tuberculosis, bring it back as a maid in the family, and as the maid in the family, she's going to communicate it to the owner's children, who are then going to die. And the last scene is the worker saying, got him. I mean, but the point is, yes, God, you got your vengeance. It's a wonderful, watch him here. You're going to see him thinking about it and says he's really angry. I'm going to get you. I got the rot in the Pratt's pottery. So I'm going to stop and go on to other things because I have lots of other things. But I like that image. I mean, you know, he's going to get him back, right? I'm just going to play this to point out a song you all know. We could all sing. Board a ship to cross the waves every day with gusto. His life in danger, yet he stands up being brave. The point being that workers are defining danger as a workplace issue, not as a technical issue. Not a technical issue that's going to be handled in the American Public Health Association, but it's going to be handled through strikes and debates. That's the tension. So I'll stop it after this verse.
High upon the scale.
Okay, everybody.
Union miners stand together. Heed no operator's tale. Keep your hand upon the dollar. And your eye upon the stick.
So we've got more, but you got the point. You got the point. Let me just play this one, a couple of other songs for you, because I think you're getting the point that there's contention. Who's going to control this is really important. And it comes out in the culture and, This is another song, How is Disease and Danger Being Identified? This is Merle Travis.
Job is one of the toughest there is. It's like an old fellow told me one time, once a miner, always a miner. If you work in the mines, the coal sut gets in your blood. That's according to me and according to the song. Come and listen, you fellows.
You all know this, right? I'm going to skip it because I don't have much time. But again, the demons of death, this is a working class issue.
Well, it's dark as a dungeon, damp as the dew, where the dangers are double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. Dark as a dungeon, way down in the mine.
Okay, again, I have to race through just some of the stuff that I already talked about the dangers of silicosis, the Gully Bridge disaster. These are iconic moments in the history of occupational safety and health where workers, African-American workers, 700 of them were killed on the job and buried by an undertaker who was hired by the Union Carbide Company. And it wasn't discovered until a couple of years later when Vito Marcantonio held hearings that they hired an undertaker to bury people as they were dying from acute silicosis and telling families that they didn't live, that they didn't know where their loved ones were. You remember this? These are the headlines that appear after the revelations. West Virginia's silicosis tragedy recalls long war on dread malady. This is a little history of that. 1,500 more are doomed to die. Silicosis relief organized here. Again, the struggle is a political struggle. The struggle is between labor. It's a forcing of management. And let's ask ourselves where public health was, even our section.
I said to her, made a
just play one more verse of it. You'll get the senses. This is not a pathology. This is not a pathological problem. You killed me. This next verse, that's a reference to the Gully Bridge disaster. So I'm going to go on to the next one. I want to point just 5 minutes. I'm going to get through the first eighth of the talk. I promise you. You have no idea what awaited you. But this is a picture of you all know who, the first female cabinet member at the Department of Labor. And what I want to point out to you is that the silicosis issue and the film you're about to see, the short blurb of the film you're about to see, wasn't being created and promoted by the U.S. Public Health Service. It wasn't being developed by us, experts in health. It's going to be the Department of Labor, who understands what this issue represents in the lives of workers. The reason I raise this is not to castigate ourselves, but to point out a historical problem that is evolving at this moment, which is that we are increasingly, during this period of time, before Tony Robbins and others and in this audience came out of schools of public health when after NIOSH was formed, and they've begun to define this issue as a narrow technical issue, and that is really outside of labor management relations. They are defining themselves increasingly as scientists, our forebears, unfortunately, defining ourselves as technicians who are concerned with gathering good evidence, gathering information, and not participating in the larger struggles that are going on during the 1930s. And it's a kind of a tragic statement about what's happened to our field, a field that was formed around Alice Hamilton, around the labor conditions that existed in the early part of the century, that was formed around the struggles of early 20th century industrialism. And here we are, by 1930, defining ourselves so narrowly that we can't even see the connection between the workplace. It has to be the Department of Labor that does it. It helps explain why, even today, OSHA and NIOSH are in separate arms of government. Ironically, NIOSH has probably become as important in terms of identifying with working people as is OSHA. But we could talk about that in some other incarnation. Okay, but let me just show you this. This is a film called Stop Silicosis. And notice it's promoted by the Department of Labor and its Division of Labor Standards, which is meant to counteract the Department of Labor Standards. It was the alternative to the U.S. Public Health Service's involvement in occupational health.
A wave of fear was sweeping the country. Silicosis was taking its toll from the ranks of American workers. Cause of the disease, dust. Results of the disease, disablement, poverty, death. Cure for the disease, none. Throughout America, workers exposed to dust grew fearful of their health, of their very life. 1936, amid these alarming events,
this is the second national conference around industrial disease that the Department of Labor sponsored. And I'm going to stop after this. It's a great. I just think we all really have to see her.
Findings and recommendations. And I feel it to be my duty to make this report available to the working people of the United States and to their employers by every available method. This report shows how silicosis occurs, where it occurs, and what the disease is, and it makes recommendations for its practical control. Above all, the report emphasizes that these control measures, if conscientiously adopted and applied, that silicosis can be prevented.
Again, you got the point that this is about who's going to control the narrative. I'm going to skip over this. This is just a description. It ends with an extraordinary depiction that's very much similar to the Temple of Moloch. And I'm just going to end with this because I don't have time. Just to remind you that the issue is not dead. In fact, it's becoming much more complicated as we begin to understand how disease is affecting the children, families, and communities, and how we've morphed into an attention to environmental as well as occupational disease. It's from 2005. stopping. After this, I'm finished. Don't worry.
Asbestosis, silicosis, brown lung, black lung disease. Radiation hits the children before they've even been conceived.
So I'll stop it there. And I just want to point, I just want to end with this image from a few weeks ago when I was looking out my window at my public school of public health and saw somebody drilling into the side of our building with a surgical mask. That's all you need. And this is, again, this is a picture of a graveyard, in a gravestone in Barry, Vermont, where very skilled artisans, Italian stone cutters, were brought to work in the granite fields and to create sculptures that were going to go on the sides of buildings throughout New York City, little gargoyles. And they were there with their skills, and in the course of a few years, their hand-skilled, hand-crafted objects were now being mass-produced, and their little hammer and chisels were being replaced with huge jackhammers that were called widowmakers. Okay? The point being that the industrialization of the country, and with that kind of mass mechanization, went a transformation of the workplace, a transformation of work, and a continuing struggle of who's going to identify and understand what is causing the new diseases that are now occurring around us. So thank you very much. I'm sorry for going on for so long.